Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking about the power of habit with Charles Duhigg.
Charles Duhigg is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist who writes for The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, and other publications. He is also the author of bestsellers The Power of Habit and Smarter, Faster, Better. And he's the host of Slate's podcast, How To. As a business expert, self-help expert, Charles explores habit formation and the science of productivity in order to help folks on a day-to-day basis. We are excited to have him join us to talk about how we can implement better habits, in particular when it comes to our personal finances and how we can lead a more productive life. So Charles, thank you for joining us today on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Charles, we're glad to have you. And every episode of this podcast, Matt and I, we talk about money. But at the same time, we drink a craft beer. And that's because we are fans of people prioritizing something that matters in their financial life in the here and now, while they're also saving and investing well for the future. So I want to know, that's kind of our splurge. What is your splurge? What's your craft beer equivalent?
My craft beer equivalent. I mean, I buy a lot of like gadgets. I find that like I love to check out the latest gadgets and play with them. So that's probably my splurge.
What was the last gadget you bought then?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I just bought an e-bike.
Oh yes.
And so yeah,
you're talking our language.
It has not arrived yet, but when it does, I'm excited to check it out.
Did you happen to purchase the new Radwagon?
No, I didn't. I actually did buy from Rad, though. I bought the Rad Runner.
They got like a city one or something like that?
Not the city. In fact, here, let me look it up. I can't remember exactly which one it was. It's the one with the fat wheels.
Oh, okay.
Nice.
Yeah.
Where you can kind of
like
glide.
The Rad Rover, maybe?
You're able to like
the
glide
Rad Rover.
Over curves.
Yes, the Rad Rover. That's what I bought, the Rad Rover.
I heard it feels like that you're like biking on a sofa because it's so comfortable. It's like a Cadillac.
That's not bad.
I've got the Rad Wagon, so Charles, just heads up, you're going to love it.
Do you like it?
Oh, I love it, man. I put my one-year-old on the back. We bike all over town.
And oh, good.
It's the greatest thing in the
good.
World.
So I'm excited for it.
Yeah, I mean, just e-bikes in general are amazing. They are such a way forward for individuals to be able to take on bike commuting, even losing a car, like cutting a car from their lives. You know, just the ability to get across town with an e-bike is completely changed the game. We're huge fans of it.
Yeah,
I'm excited.
Yeah. Charles, I saw that you've been featured. You've been a guest on the Now Defunct Colbert Report.
Yes.
I've actually been in the audience before. Was that a fun experience for you? What was that like?
Yeah, it was great. It was great. I mean, he's a fantastic host. And the whole show is kind of fun. You know, I think anytime you do shows like that, like it actually goes by very, very quickly.
Oh, yeah.
I really enjoyed it. It was fantastic.
Yeah, he was. That was kind of an incredible role that he had for those years. It might not work. Matt and I were discussing as well right now in today's time, but it was so good when he
it was a parody back then. But today it's like, oh, no, like a lot of folks are taking it that extreme in real life. It's almost not as funny anymore. Whereas, you know, years ago it was hilarious.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true.
Charles, let's talk about your podcast. We're fans first of the name of your podcast, by the way. You're one word away from the perfect podcast name. But let's talk about some of the topics you've covered on your podcast, How To. There's one really interesting one that you did not too long ago about convincing people to give you money. You highlighted con artists and folks that run nonprofits as being especially good at this. So what did you learn in that episode about how to effectively get people to give you money?
Well, we had on this woman named Maria Konnikova, who wrote a book about con artists and about how con artists work. Who actually, she just published another book called The Big Bet, about her learning to become a poker professional. Mm-hmm. And what Maria says in her book, which is really interesting, is she points out that, you know, the con artists kind of operate according to a formula. And part of that formula is basically knowing who their mark is and what their mark wants to hear, and then tailoring their pitch to that and giving it a sense of exclusiveness, giving it a sense of scarcity, giving it something where they believe that they are helping other people, although they are also helping themselves. So one of the best cons is something where the person's going to make money. They believe that they're going to make money on by giving you some money, they're going to make more money. But it's also like, well, you're also helping like the children, right? You're helping like, you know, someone off in another country. You're doing a real favor to them because that way they can dress up their own greed right. in kind of this need for to, in virtuousness. And what's really interesting is that when you talk to folks who do nonprofit fundraising, a lot of the tactics are very, very similar, that you need to tell people that even though they're giving money to a cause, like to a nonprofit, you need to tell them how it's going to benefit them. But then you dress it up in this, you know, you're making the world a better place and we're going to put your name on a building. So it's really all about sort of like about how awesome you are, but we're going to let you have a self-righteousness that allows you to feel like you're doing this for the right reasons.
Right.
And so that was really interesting, is to sort of figure out like what we know is that we know that there is the psychology behind how people treat their money, right? You guys know this. And so a lot of the tactics that con artists use aren't that dissimilar from the tactics that fundraisers use, even when they're doing it for a good cause.
Yeah, and even in a less con artist type of way, you can use those approaches. You can use those tactics when it comes to, like, say, asking for a raise, right? You know, if you are trying to convince your employer that how it is that you are helping them, how you're helping the company, well, that's literally what you need to do when you actually are asking for a raise. The Charles, more recently, I think my favorite episode was one that you did about acing virtual schooling, you know, on Zoom. What did you take away from that episode about how to think about our kids and screen time? In, you know, these COVID times?
Well, it's really hard, right? I mean, I think that like kids are suffering right now way more than we even understand. I have two children myself and they've been doing virtual school. Now they're back in, one of them is back in day-to-day school and the other one is still virtual schooling. It's really, really challenging. And I think that one of the things that we've learned is just that this interactivity is really important. That being with other people is really important. If you can't be with other people, that figuring out how to foster conversation. You know, I've found this on my own doing Zoom calls. I'm sure you guys have too. That one of the challenges is that you lose all of this kind of ease of what's known as back channeling within psychology, the people saying yes, sort of showing with their body whether they're following along or they're distracted. Even when people are thinking, it's harder to know that on Zoom. Right. If you're sitting in a room with someone, oftentimes we use eye contact to signal when someone else should feel free to speak, right? We tend not to look at each other in the eyes when we're speaking, but then when we finish a thought, we tend to look at someone else in the eyes, and that's kind of an almost unconscious signal that person can go ahead and start speaking. The problem is on Zoom, if someone's, you know, if you're sitting in a room with someone and they're looking off into the corner, which is totally normal, you can look in the corner and see that they're not looking at anything. And you know that they're sort of just thinking about what they're saying. On Zoom, if they're looking off into a corner, it looks like they're distracted or we don't know what they're looking at. And so this distance communication has been really challenging. In some ways, I think it's actually more challenging with Zoom than it is without Zoom. I think verbal communication is actually easier in some respects than verbal plus video. And so when it comes to kids and Zoom school, one of the things that we've learned is that you really have to spend some time thinking about how are you going to keep that kid engaged? How are you going to make it easier for them to pay attention? Because it's just so hard, so easy to get distracted and to kind of tune out.
Yeah, no, that's true. I found that with my kids and especially a kindergartner trying to get used to school in the first place, much less school virtually. It's pretty rough. It's pretty rough. Charles, let's talk about habits for just a little bit. Your best-selling book, The Power of Habit, it's just really, really good. And so many great stories weaved in there that brought your points home. But what kind of actually spawned your initial interest in taking on that subject in general?
Well, you know, I was just interested in, I sort of had this basic question, which is like, if I'm so smart at other stuff, right? I had gone to Yale for college and to Harvard Business School to get my MBA, and yet there were all these things that I still felt like I'd struggled with so much, right? Like I struggled to eat more healthily. I struggled to make myself exercise more. And I just kept on thinking, like, if I'm so smart, like, why is it so hard to do these things that I see other people do all the time, right? Like, why is it hard for me to master my habits? And so the goal of writing the book was in part just to educate myself, like, how do habits work? If I understand them better, will that help me understand how to control my own habits? And it turns out that we are and were living through this sort of golden age of understanding habit research. That for the first time, because of advances in neurology and other psychological sciences, that there was this ability to understand and observe habits at the most minute level. And so once I started looking into that, I thought it was fascinating and decided, like, that's what I want to write a book about, because I wanted to learn it for myself, but then also share it with other people.
Yeah. Personal growth, right? Yeah. That's a great excuse to dive into that research. And in your book as well, you cite a study that shows that like around 45% of daily activities are habits. Like, we don't even think about them, right? And so does this mean that like half of our lives are like we're just reacting to cues? And, you know, we're kind of doing things just mostly without thinking?
Makes me think I'm a robot or something.
Yeah. So it's 40 to 45%. And what it means is, I mean, to be clear what a habit is a choice that you make at some point, and then you stop making the choice, but you continue doing it, right? So the first time that you walked into the, walked into the cafeteria at work, you decided to go get a sandwich instead of a salad, even though the salad was healthier. And then you just kept on doing that without kind of consciously making the decision. What we know is that our brains are designed to actually basically kind of stop spending so much energy when we're in the grip of a habit. That's why habits are so useful, is because they free up cognitive capacity for other tasks, even when we're driving to work or walking down the street. So what that means is that, you know, 40 to 45% of what we do every day, at some point you made a decision on how to spend that time, but then you just kind of continued on autopilot with, according to that decision, without reconsidering it. And so the more that you can sort of analyze your own habits and say, like, oh, look, I'm doing this behavior because of a habit, and there's a cue and there's a reward that's driving that activity, that routine, the more control you get over actually making the habits that you want to have, rather than the ones that just kind of emerge without our permission.
Hmm. Charles, we want to talk more about habit formation and get your tips on breaking bad habits. And this, of course, applies to how we handle money at the same time. We'll get to some of that right after this break.
All right, we are back from the break talking with Charles Duhigg about habits. And Charles, you write about specifically the habit loop in your book, but I'd love to discuss how we can break bad habits that we might have fallen into, right?
Yeah.
Bad habits, they can cause us to spend money, maybe emotionally, waste time on social media, other things, right? You write how habits can develop into even a massive gambling addiction that's almost impossible to curb. You give an example in your book. So how in the world do we actually kick a bad habit?
Well, the first thing is to realize that thinking in terms of breaking a bad habit is exactly the wrong way to think about it. And that's part of the lexicon, right? We say, like, I want to break a bad habit. But that's not how habits work. With willpower, you might be able to extinguish a habit that you don't like for a little while. But as soon as you feel stressed, or as soon as, like, you know, you have a moment of weakness, it's going to come back because that neural pathway is still in your brain. So the way to think about it is as changing a bad habit, replacing one behavior with another behavior rather than breaking that bad habit. And to do that, you have to understand how habits work. And you mentioned the habit loop. So the thing about habits is that every habit has three parts. There's a cue, which is a trigger for an automatic behavior to start. And then the routine, which is the behavior itself. And then finally, a reward. Every habit in your life, whether you're aware of it or not, is delivering a reward to you. And a part of your brain known as the basal ganglia exists to kind of recognize that reward and make that chunk of behavior, that cue, routine, reward, easier and easier to do for you. So if you have a bad habit and you want to change it, the first thing to do is to identify the cue and the reward. Try and figure out, you know, what is triggering this behavior and what reward is it delivering it to me. And then find a new behavior, a new routine that you can insert into that habit loop that corresponds to that old cue and that delivers something similar to that old reward. So for many people, let's take smoking as an example, right? Because we think of smoking as a particularly pernicious habit, an addiction. And nicotine is addicting. It's actually less addicting than we sort of popularly know it is. About 100 hours after your last cigarette, nicotine is out of your bloodstream, and people are no longer physically addicted to nicotine.
So it's less the drug and it's more the habit is what you're saying.
Well, yeah, exactly. People get in the habit of smoking. And so, you know, weeks after giving up cigarettes, years, they still feel that urge for a cigarette when they're sitting down with their morning coffee. You know, if you have that urge years after giving up cigarettes, that's clearly not a physical addiction. That's a habit dysfunction. But habits exist in the same part of our brain as addictions. And so they feel very, very similar. And so if you want to give up cigarettes, you can just go cold turkey and throw them away. But a better thing to do is to try and figure out, okay, what reward is smoking giving me? And for many people, it's that smoking provides a break from work, right? So you need something else that's going to provide a break from work, some new routine that delivers similar reward. For some people, smoking actually calms them down, right? The nicotine has a kind of calming effect, in which case they need to find something else to calm themselves down. For some people, it gives them a little bit more energy, so they need to start drinking coffee when they would normally smoke in order to replace that behavior. But that's kind of the point, is that you don't break a bad habit. It, you change it. And once you change it, then that change becomes much more sustainable.
And what about just forming a new habit, like just out of the blue, right? And we're in a time of year where people are probably particularly thinking about starting a new habit and creating, you know, some change in their lives. And so, you know, a lot of our listeners in particular are like, well, how can I maybe spend more mindfully this year or actually stick to a budget? If they're looking to start from scratch to create a good habit right now, where do you suggest they start?
So this is a great question. We actually just recorded a podcast episode about this.
Oh, great.
It's going to be coming out next week about how to create good spending habits. And there's a couple of things that people should keep in mind. Number one is, you know, first of all, you just have to have the basic, like, sort of money hygiene. So, like, if you have debt, you should be paying down your debt. If you should absolutely have a budget. Like, if you don't have a monthly and weekly budget, then, and if you're not tracking what you're spending, then you don't know what is going on in your own finances, and you can't possibly be on top of it.
Right.
So there's some basic money hygiene stuff that everyone should do. But then on top of that, like, the question is, well, how do we think about the habits? You know, a lot of the spending that we do, when people finally do get their budget and they track what they've spent every week, what they see is that they're wasting a lot of money, right? They're oftentimes wasting money on things like going to Starbucks. They're wasting money on, you know, buying, particularly during the pandemic, buying things from Amazon. This woman we were talking to yesterday said she feels anxious if she doesn't have an Amazon package coming, which sounds ridiculous, but I totally understand, right? Because I think lots of people feel that way. And then on top of that is this question of what are the rewards that these are providing? You know, people spend too much money going to restaurants and on food. That's always something that people overspend on. They buy too much food, or they buy food from restaurants, or they're going to, you know, Whole Foods rather than the local grocery store that's cheaper. And so once you know what your habits are by tracking what you're actually doing, then you can start asking yourself, okay, so what rewards are this actually providing, right? Am I buying because I'm bored? During the pandemic, the answer is often yes. People are bored.
True.
They need a break from, like, their Zoom calls. They're online and they go to Amazon, or they go to one of these websites that, like, has, like, you know, here's like the 10 new things you should buy, or X
or Instagram, which is just constantly feeding you stuff to buy too now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so, like, are you buying stuff because you need it, or are you buying stuff because you're bored? Chances are you're buying stuff because you're bored. Very often. And so then the question becomes, okay, so the answer is not to just say, I'm going to stop going to those websites because you're still going to be bored. The answer is to say, how do I come up with something else that solves that boredom? How do I come up with something else that provides the reward that I used to get from shopping, which is some novelty, some sense of excitement about the future? And there's lots of different ways to do that, right? Like, once you pose the problem that way, you can say, oh, instead of like, you know, if I'm bored, instead of, like, going and surfing to that website, I'm going to let myself watch 10 minutes of TV, right? I'm going to turn on a TV show and I'm going to watch it on my computer. Instead of going to Amazon, I'm just for 10 minutes, I'm going to go to, or Instagram for 10 minutes. I'm going to go and I'm going to watch The Queen's Gambit for 10 minutes,
yes.
Right? And, like, I'm going to set a timer. But the point is that, like, that's a cheaper way of solving your boredom. And the more that you break it down and you say, what rewards is this spending giving me? The more you're going to get closer to figuring out a way to make it easier for yourself.
Right. Yeah. You shared another example, too, where just snacking can be a habit when in reality you realize that you're not hungry. You're just looking for some socialization. I know. Yeah. I kind of fall into that same trap when I'm sitting here working. I have a tendency to think, OK, maybe it's time for another coffee. But what I really need is just a break. And so even just standing up, grabbing a kettlebell, which is, it's also a healthy kind of thing to do. But like doing some kettlebell swings gets the blood flowing. And all of a sudden I'm feeling ready to continue working.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So like I think that's exactly right. Like we want an excuse to stand up and walk around. And the easiest way to stand up and walk around is to walk over to the kitchen and get something to eat. But like right. You can just as easily stand up, and once you realize that what you really want is to stand up and walk around, you can stand up and walk around the other direction and pick up a kettlebell, or just go outside and walk around the block.
Just walk away from the fridge.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, in your book, too, The Power of Habit, Charles, you also credit community and peer pressure as reasons why certain habits tend to remain sticky. Given the increased isolation so many of us have felt during the pandemic and obviously the decrease in-person community, how have you seen that impact individuals in the way they exhibit habits and behaviors?
Well, I think that strangely, many people are feeling a stronger sense of community during the pandemic. Mm. They tend, one of the things that undermines community is not spending enough time with the same group of people. So one of the things that we know is that like having a community, it doesn't matter how many people are in the community. It matters how much time you're spending with those people. And so in many of our daily lives, you can be around, 100 people in a day, 80 people in a day, but you're not really interacting with many of them for more than a couple of minutes. If you take like Alcoholics Anonymous as an example, one of the important things about Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's very stable. It typically has a very stable time. It happens at the same time every day. Very stable structure. It usually opens with someone telling a story about themselves, and you sort of say these similar things each time. And equally importantly, you tend to have a pretty stable group of people there. So you see the same people usually each time you go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that stability is an important part of why that community feels supportive. So one of the things that's happening right now with the pandemic is, you're exactly right, we see less people, and so our community has shrunk, but we tend to spend a lot more time with the people that we see because we're at home with them. Or we're on Zoom calls with them all day long. And so what we found is that for some people, community has actually been strengthened in some ways. Now, that doesn't mean it's easier, right? That doesn't mean that like that community feels really invigorating, because you have to put work into a community and it's not supposed to feel like fun all the time. But for people who feel like they're missing community, I think that's part of the solution, is to find people to touch base with, the same people to touch base with on a regular basis. So to have a regular, once a week Zoom call with your friend, where you guys know you're going to get on at Friday at noon every week and you're going to have a Zoom lunch together, that's really important.
Charles, you also end up boiling a whole lot down to the power of belief. Why is belief so important, and how do we develop a deeper sense of belief in ourselves in order to affect change?
Well, so believing that you can change is really important to making change effective. And what we know about belief is that the best way to actually learn to believe in yourself is to practice believing in anything, right? Like, so again, to return to Alcoholics Anonymous, not that AA is like perfect, but there's a lot of sort of interesting lessons there. One of the steps in AA is that they tell you to believe in a higher power. Now, they don't say it has to be religious. They don't say it has to be God. It could be like, my higher power is democracy. But they do encourage you to believe in something larger than yourself. And I think the reason why that's so important is because basically what they're doing is they're getting people to practice believing in things. And eventually that muscle, that believing muscle, gets strengthened and people can learn how to believe in themselves. And so the thing that I think is really helpful if people are struggling with things is, and they want to build up their capacity to believe that they can change, is what's known as the science of small wins. Basically, to take these baby steps. What we know about how change happens is that most change happens because people have small, incremental, non-linear successes that lead up to a big change. So instead of saying, I'm going to go run a marathon, they say, tomorrow morning, I'm going to go for a walk around the block. And they go for a walk around the block, and it's not that hard. And they they have this small win, right? I went for a block, and they believe, like, I'm the kind of person who can go for a walk around the block. And then the next day they say, okay, so I went for a walk around the block, now I'm going to go around the walk for two blocks. And they do that. And eventually they get so tired of just walking, they're like, I'm going to take a jog, and I'm going to jog for half a mile. And these small baby steps, this science of small wins, that is how we learn to believe in ourselves, is by practicing belief in smaller, low-stakes cases. And that's really, really important, because we can do that for anything, whether it's saving money or getting in better shape. As long as you can sort of find some ways to take baby steps, then you know that you're going to be in a position where you can train yourself to believe that change is possible.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's awesome. I loved that insight from the book for sure. And it really is powerful. It's something that we can use to our advantage. Charles, we have just a few more questions for you, including what it looks like to create a to-do list that we can actually take charge of and do well, that will actually influence us for the better. And we'll get to some of those questions right after this break. All right, we are back from the break talking with Charles Duhigg about habits. And Charles, before we talk about, you know, kind of optimizing our life, I wanted to touch real quickly too on keystone habits. You mentioned that in your book. You mentioned how they can kind of create habit momentum in your life, you know? And so can you share what keystone habits are and why it is that they're so important?
Yeah. So a keystone habit, one of the things that we've learned from research on habits is that some habits seem to matter more than others, because when they start to change, they set off a chain reaction that changes other patterns as well. So a great example of this is exercise, right? For many people, exercise is a keystone habit. And when they start exercising habitually, what happens is that they start eating more healthily as well. Their eating habits change. And that kind of weirdly makes sense to us, right? Everyone's kind of experienced that. You go for a run in the morning, and then when you go to have lunch, it's easier to get the salad rather than the, you know, unhealthy hamburger. But what's interesting is that when we look at people who've started exercising habitually, for many of them, when that habit starts, they also start using their credit cards less. They tend to procrastinate less at work. They and this is my favorite finding, they do their dishes, like wash their dishes, on average 20 minutes earlier in the day when they've exercised. And that makes less intuitive sense to us, right? Like, none of us think of ourselves as going out for a run and think like, oh, I'm going to keep my Amex in my pocket today rather than taking it out. And yet what we know is that the same way that exercise habits change eating habits, they change other patterns in our lives as well. And that's because for many people, exercise is a keystone habit. It changes how we see ourselves. And that change has an almost subconscious influence on other choices that we make. And so for many people, the question is, how can you identify the keystone habits in your life, the changes you can make that will set off a chain reaction, that will change other patterns? And the answer is to look for those changes that kind of seem irrationally scary, right? For the reason why exercise is such a powerful keystone habit for so many people is because oftentimes it's not a keystone habit for people who are like high school athletes. Like, people who are accustomed to seeing themselves as athletic usually will not see a big change in their life when they start exercising on a regular basis after like a period of inactivity. But it's for people who were not high school athletes, the people who like never thought of themselves as athletes, when they start running, you know, three times a week, they start subtly thinking of themselves as a different kind of person. They start thinking of themselves as the kind of person who manages to run three times a week. And that kind of person doesn't spend recklessly. That kind of person doesn't eat unhealthily. And so the key is to look for those types of change that seem irrationally scary to you. And that's usually a clue that if you change it, it'll change your self-image a little bit, and that'll have an impact on the other patterns in your life.
So are there any things that you found in going through all the research and through writing your book, that any keystone habits that particularly affected how we handle our money?
So thinking of yourself as a saver, right? Like somebody who, here's how I do my money. I use Mint to track all of my purchases, right? It ties in all my bank accounts. Every single week, once a week, I sit down and I have a spreadsheet on Excel. And I fill in all these things in the spreadsheet with how much money is in my bank accounts, how much credit card, like how much is on my credit cards right now, how much is in my 401k, how much is in my investments. I have like, you know, 10 or 12 cells that I fill in on that spreadsheet. And then there's these little formulas that tell me how much I spent compared to last week, how much more I, how much money is in, whether my net balance is up or down from last week, how much money I've made overall, except, you know, how much more is on my credit card or less on my credit card. And so this is a habit for me. I do it every single week. And the thing that it does is it makes me very, very aware of the money patterns in my life. It also makes me think of myself as someone who thinks about money, who thinks about, like, and cares about where my money is going. And I think in part that's why writing a budget and tracking your own spending is so powerful, is because not only does it give you the data to kind of see what's going on and see where you're spending too much, but if you do it regularly, if you stick with that budget, if you look each day to see what you spent on or each week, you start thinking of yourself as the kind of person who cares about where their money is going. And that kind of person, that kind of person does not make frivolous purchases quite as easily. Hmm. And so the number one keystone habit for people around money that can change how they spend is to create a budget and update their budget regularly, because that habit not only gives you information, but it also changes how you see yourself when it comes to money.
I love that. Yeah, that change in identity is what happens there.
Right.
Charles, in your book, Smarter, Faster, Better, you talk more about focus in an age of information overload. In the world of personal finance, you know, information can be blinding. So how do we filter the information that is helpful versus the stuff that we should probably ignore?
The first thing to understand is that more information is not better. Oftentimes it's worse, right? You can overwhelm yourself with information and basically not learn anything as a result. So the key is that you really don't want more than at the most 3 data points that you're paying attention to. And it's pretty, and like if you have less than 3, that's even better. So like at first you can just say, look, I want to compare my bank account balances this week with the same time last week and see if they've gone up and down. And I want to compare, you know, how much I spent on food this week with how much I budgeted for food this week. And just starting small that way and really like focusing in on that, because that whatever we focus on, we're going to be able to change. And if you focus on, if you have 15 categories in your budget and each week you look at all 15 categories and you're trying to figure out what's going on, if you do that at first, you're not going to make any changes. You're going to be so like overwhelmed by the amount of information you have. So the key is at first, choose 1 or 2, at most 3 data points to pay attention to. Now, over time, you might get to a place where you can do more data points, right? You know, 2 months down the road, you're like, okay, now I'm looking at 2 other things. I'm looking at food and I'm looking at, you know, how much I'm spending on commuting. But only once I get food under control do I start paying attention to that commuting budget. The key is to not let yourself feel productive because you're looking at a lot of data and not actually get anything done. The less data you are looking at, the higher the odds that you're actually going to change what you're paying attention to.
That's great stuff. Yeah, I want to ask you too, Charles, about to-do lists. They're just kind of one of these simple, but typically they ineffective sometimes and super effective depending on how you use them. But they can be used really well. And you've talked about how you create a better to-do list that actually helps us get more done. Like, what's the trick to making a to-do list that's actually successful?
Yeah, so it's very similar to focus, which is that what we know from studies is that most people create to-do lists that have like 20 or 30 things on them, because what they're actually using their to-do list is as a memory aid. Rather than trying to remember things, they put it on a piece of paper. And that's great, because it's much easier to remember things when they're written down than trying to carry them around in your brain. But then they make this mistake, which is they say, okay, this memory aid that I've developed, that's my to-do list. And that's not the right way of doing things, because what will happen, and we know this from studies, is that oftentimes people will look for the easiest things on that list and do them because it feels so good to cross them off.
Oh, yeah.
So what's
I think you mentioned that sometimes people write something down that they've already done just so they can put a checkmark
exactly.
next to it.
Like something like 30% of people who write to-do lists, they'll write down a task they've already completed because it feels so good to cross
Guilty.
It off.
Guilty, yeah.
So the key is like you should have a memory aid that's a piece of paper, but then you should have another piece of paper, which is your to-do list, and you should not have more than 3 things on that to-do list. And what should be on that to-do list is, number one, the most important thing to do today. Number two, if you get that first thing done, the next most important thing to do, and number three, what you suspect is the most important thing for tomorrow, but you might change it when you write tomorrow's to-do list. And you write a new to-do list every single morning, and the goal of a to-do list is not to simply help you remember things, it's to prioritize things. And that's why you never want more than three things on it, is because the act of writing a to-do list is to force you to decide what is the most important thing I want to get done today, and then putting that as the top priority and ignoring everything else.
Yeah, there's a difference between doing the things that you need to do right now versus just all the things that are in your mind that you want to have a list of somewhere else,
exactly,
but that's not
right.
Necessarily your to-do list.
That's exactly right.
So, Charles, thank you so much for taking the time to hang out with us today. Where can people find more about you and your podcast?
They can find, so if they just look for How To with Charles Duhigg on Slate, they can find the podcast wherever they listen to podcasts, and they can find out more about me or about The Power of Habit or Smarter, Faster, Better just by Googling any of those words or going to CharlesDuhigg.com, or I'm C. Duhigg on Twitter if folks want to follow me.
Awesome. Thanks again for your time today, Charles. We appreciate
it. Thank you. Take care.
Joel, man, what a great conversation we just had here with Charles about habits and, you know, in particular this time of year as folks are basically thinking through, like, how can they become a better person this year, how it is they can stick to their New Year's resolutions. Talking about habits and how they're formed and how it is that we stick to them is so important. So I'm glad we had this conversation today, man. What was your big takeaway today?
One, I'm just proud of Charles for getting an e-bike because e-bikes are the future. So, yeah, way to go.
And of course, he gets a rad power bike. I mean, everybody is getting those bikes these days. They're so affordable.
So even though Charles and I have never met in person, we can be best friends. It works.
Yeah, you have that kindred spirit.
Exactly. And yeah, it was definitely hard to pick one takeaway from this episode. Man, it was jam-packed full of knowledge and just a lot of interesting insight. But I think my biggest one was that small wins are so important. And, you know, one of the things that he said was, if you're not a natural budgeter, or if you kind of hate budgeting in particular, or really anybody, like, you should focus on fewer data points. And I think when we're trying to come up with a budget, and you and I don't know, maybe 6 months ago, we had an episode where we talked about different styles of budgeting for mm-hmm. different personalities. And we mentioned simpler being better.
For a lot of folks, that's what they need.
Right. And that was echoed in this conversation, that the simpler your budget, the more effectively you're going to be able to stick to it. So concentrate maybe on a few data points that most negatively impact your budget. And if you can just, over the course of a few months, pay attention to those two or three things where you find yourself overspending, then you don't necessarily have to have just this robust budget that you're checking on a weekly basis that's overwhelming you, that you're not going to be able to stick to. If instead you focus on just a few data points, I think it will help you be able to actually find budgeting as a useful tool in 2021. So yeah, I don't know. That was my big takeaway.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was a lot of gold in this one. So what was yours?
It was good. No, yeah. I mean, it's certainly the power of focus, right? You know, to focus on a few of those things and make sure that you succeed at those things versus getting bogged down by all the details. I mean, it's something we talked about even in our year-end review episode. But for me, my big takeaway, man, was kind of when we talked about Keystone Habits, and he writes more about this in his book. But, you know, he elaborated more here in the conversation how when you start doing something that's really scary to you, how you when you have this irrational fear of doing something.
I have lots of irrational fears, Matt.
But you should pay attention to those things. You know, like when you feel that way about something, it's like, okay, what is it about this thing that makes me feel that way? And he's pointing out that as we confront those fears and as we change our behaviors, we also change our identity. You know, in particular, he highlighted exercise. For a lot of people, they see that as this scary thing. Like, how do you get to the point where you're just going to work 9 to 5 and working versus, you know, seeing the people on the weekends running marathons or triathlons, that kind of thing. There's a wide chasm between those two points.
Yeah, I thought one of the most interesting things that he said about exercise, which is always the thing that goes through my mind, is I don't have enough time to do that. Yeah. But the point he made was that people that exercise actually have more time in their lives. It's fascinating how
you do the dishes sooner in the day.
Yeah, it's fascinating how that works. And so I need to stop using that as an excuse and start working on my habit.
Yeah, yeah. And so I just love the fact that by confronting these fears, though, how you literally start thinking of yourself differently. You know, you start exercising a little bit, you go for a run around the block, and all of a sudden, I am an exerciser. Yeah. Like, that's just, it becomes a part of your identity. And I love that. And the same thing when it comes to, like, looking at your money. He knows that by looking at his money once a week, that has changed the way that he views his own personal finances. You know, he then sees that, oh, I am a saver. This is who I am. It becomes a part of who you are. And when you have a sense of identity like that, you are invested to stick with it.
No doubt. So yeah, I hope that information was helpful to all of our listeners as they're looking to either, you know, kick off a new habit this year. In particular, in all likelihood, if they're listening to this show, a positive habit, positive habits in regard to their personal finances, or really just any habit. This was a conversation that I think can help you potentially stick to some of those New Year's resolutions that you might have already made. All right, Matt, let's get back to the beer that we had while we were talking with Charles. This one was called Boys in the Yard, Milkshake IPA, and the reason it's called...
It's actually Boys in the Yard.
I love a good boysenberry pun, and so that's what this one was. It was literally an IPA with boysenberries tossed in from a local brewery down the street from us called Wrecking Bar Brew Pub. Matt, what were your thoughts on this beer, man?
Yeah, Wrecking Bar is one of our favorite local brew pubs here in Atlanta. And dude, one of the first things I thought of as you mentioned, the boysenberries is like, what is a boysen? Makes me think of that old Mitch Hedberg joke. But like boysenberries aren't something you regularly see. You know, it's not like a typical berry that you would pick up at the grocery store. At least if you have, it's not one that I have.
Right. No, me neither. I'm like strawberries, blueberries.
Yeah.
Maybe some raspberries I'm getting crazy.
It's like one of those berries that you cook with that find their way into beers or other dishes like that. But I've never had a boysenberry on its own, and like, what does a boysen tree or bush look like? I'm curious to know. But I really enjoy this one, man. This was, like you said, a milkshake IPA, so it was kind of creamy. It's got some of that lactose sugar in there, but it also had some of that fruitiness that a boysenberry adds. Not having had a boysenberry separately, I can't necessarily pick it out. You know, I'm like, oh, I can really taste the boysenberry notes. I taste fruit, and so therefore that makes me think, oh, that must be boysen.
Must be.
But I did enjoy it. This is one that you just picked up a couple days ago, and they had just canned this, so it's really fun to have a really fresh, crisp IPA like this. Really enjoyed it, man. Yeah, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, man. I love the smooth vibe of a milkshake IPA. That lactose smoothness just kind of is a different mouthfeel, which I enjoy from time to time. And yeah, the boysenberry action combined with the hot, it's just kind of a fascinating flavor profile. And yeah, I think it can be done poorly, the milkshake IPA, but this one was done quite well. So yeah, I love everything Wrecking Bar puts out. One of our favorite local breweries. So yeah, another winner today. By the way, one thing Charles said that we haven't talked about, he mentioned the Queen's Gambit. Everyone, if you're late to the game on this, you should totally watch the Queen's Gambit. Such an excellent, excellent show on Netflix.
You've burned your way through the full first season by now, right?
Oh yeah. I don't know if there's a second season coming, but if there is, I'll be watching.
Nice, man. Yeah, that's not one that Kate and I have started yet. We didn't get to that over the holidays, but maybe we will soon.
You should.
Yeah. All right. Well, folks can find our show notes up on our website at howtomoney.com. We'll make sure to link to Charles' podcast and his books as well, where you can learn more about the different things he has written about.
Yeah. And by the way, every other Monday, when we're not interviewing somebody, Matt and I are answering your listener questions. And especially if you're a new listener and you're kind of trying to figure out how money works, or you've got some questions about your personal finances, well, we'd love to take your question on an upcoming episode. Just go to howtomoney.com/ask. Simple instructions there to send a voice memo our way, and hopefully we can take your question on an upcoming episode. All right, Matt, that's going to do it for this episode though. So until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.